Hello and welcome to another episode of It's Just As Fantasy, for podcast where every week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Jordy Bailey.
And I'm the man with no name, not that one, the other one in this book, Duncan Nichol.
Duncan, we're going back to a familiar well this time. He hasn't let us down so far. We are reading Joe Abercrombie's Red Country, the finale to the second trilogy in the First Law series of multiple trilogies.
It's the final book in the trilogy of standalones following the original trilogy.
The trilogy of standalones that all take place in chronological order and in which characters frequently reappear from one series into another.
That's the one.
Cool.
I have so much I want to say about this, Jordy. It really was an incredible read. Sorry, spoilers for the review we're about to give. So, lightning fast, has there been anything else you've enjoyed other than Red Country?
As it happens, I have been reading something else. Am I enjoying it? Ooh, it's hard to say, to be honest, which surprises me. Duncan, I'm way overdue for reading this, considering how excited I was for its release. I've started reading The Daughter War by Christopher Buhlmann.
Ah, the follow-up prequel to The Black Tongue Thief.
Exactly, yes, the follow-up prequel. What I love about it, beautifully written, as one would expect. I had forgotten just how amazing of a writer Christopher Buhlmann is, but it's also just interminably slow. I'm a quarter of the way through the book and nothing has happened.
Well, that's a little bit, that's a little bit kind of disappointing to hear, because The Black Tongue Thief, that was a book that got going. It had sort of like mini episodic adventures. Slow is not a word I would have applied to the first book in the series.
I know, I'm astounded, and part of the reason is what makes it so good. It really just luxuriates in its own space, it lets the characters do the talking, it fills it up with a sense of history, both personal and, like, historical. But a quarter of the way through it, nothing has happened! It just looked like something really exciting was about to happen. It was about to be a huge goblin fight. Nothing happened. Didn't happen. Got completely sidewinded by something else. So, disappointing, but I'm way too early to give concrete opinions about story, so another time. Duncan, have you been reading anything else?
Yes, I have, and no, I won't be talking about it in detail. So, I've been reading Priory of the Orange Tree, which, if you're a long-time listener, you will know we've been trying to read through and review for what feels like 2 months now. It is coming, people. I just need to keep cracking away at it.
But there is a countdown now, Duncan. Do you think you will be able to bring it home before the next
episode? Listen, I'm not making any promises. I'm just telling you, I will give it my best.
All a man can do, Duncan, is his best, no matter how the world tests him.
I might just read like the last 10 pages, look up a plot synopsis and just kind of flag it. I would never do that. I have integrity, don't worry.
I feel like a tiny shot was fired at me there for failing to read Jiril of Joyry. Duncan, if you cannot bring yourself to finish Priory of the Orange Tree, that's totally fine by me, and I will gladly accept your destiny token.
I love that format point. Yes, the ability to force me to read a book in the series that we've already started, and I'm not letting us continue. Georgie will probably spend that to continue Scholomance.
I shouldn't have to, Duncan. I really shouldn't have to. Enough of that, let's get into the book, because I'm really excited to talk about Red Country. I'm not going to hold anything back. I had a cracking time with this one. I really loved it.
And so did I. So we'll be going straight into a lot of spoilers. I don't think we can get around that, but I will just hand out a quick kind of cell synopsis, I guess, of what Red Country is. So like we said, this is a continuation of the First Law universe, but it is its own story. There are familiar characters and character arcs are continued, but the plot itself is a standalone adventure, and for the first time in First Law, it becomes a western. And not just that it's set in sort of a western sort of thing setting. When I say western, I'm talking about the Wild West, and maybe a bit more the Wild West as it exists in spaghetti westerns than maybe it existed. I don't know, not a historian.
It's really strange how well he writes that, he follows that line, that this is definitively Joe Abercrombie has decided to write a Western, but it's still a Joe Abercrombie story, and it still feels like the others. And what's more, the really fascinating thing about it is, although there is carryover between certain characters appearing, one character, for example, I believe, I might be wrong about this, the only character to appear in all three of these stories, Cole Shivers, he shows up again. But you realize every single story is a different type of fantasy completely. I don't know if this was the case for the original First Law trilogy, but like...
I can tell you it wasn't.
Yeah, that's what I
think. That was much more classic by the book.
This one, the first one, Best Served Cold, is a slightly more episodic story of revenge. So it feels more like, you know, Dishonored more than anything. And then you have the heroes, which completely breaks with any kind of familiar format. It's focused around a singular battle. It's a singular, like, five-day span, all about war and politics and stuff. And there's this one, which is completely different. It takes place over the span of months, or even, like, maybe a year or more. And it's this winding story, which doesn't really resemble any of the other ones in any way except tone.
It's incredibly well done. I cannot emphasize that enough. And if you're someone who maybe has been listening along and have read Best Served Cold and the heroes following our reviews, and you don't want to be spoiled on this book, if you haven't made it clear already, you can go and read it. Go, buy, read, enjoy. It's incredible. But if you're sticking around to hear our thoughts, Geordie, how does this story kick off? How does our Western get going?
So, it's, you talked before about how this book takes its inspiration, and you'll visit a lot of real familiar stories. You got a little bit of Deadwood, you got a little bit of Fistful of Dollars, you got a little bit True Grit, you got a little bit, what's the one where they're just going in a direction? Miller's Crossing? Something like that. But the way we kick off, and the main influence about the whole story, is the Searchers. A family's farm is burnt down, their children are abducted, their friends are killed, and they set out on two quests. A quest to get the kids back, and a quest for revenge. If you've seen The Searchers, one of the best fantasy movies of all time, then you pretty much know where the story's going. But you'll be hit by a lot of surprises along the way. Oh, and I forgot the one other massive influence on the story, Unforgiven.
I just want to drop in here, by the way, Geordie. When it comes to, like, Westerns, despite talking about how much this revels in the tropes, and I'm kind of vaguely aware through cultural osmosis of a lot of what's in these Western movies, I probably have only actually watched 4 Westerns in my life.
Are they any of the ones that I've mentioned?
They are Fistful of Dollars, Few Dollars More, True Grit, and The Magnificent Seven.
Which True Grit? And which Magnificent Seven?
The original Magnificent Seven and the remake of True Grit.
Good choices, good choices. I think you actually chose the right way there. Yeah, I think I'm a little bit more familiar with Westerns. I wouldn't say I'm a huge fan. I've seen a fair few. The ones you've mentioned and like... the original True Grit, which I watched a lot when I was a kid. God, what else? Seven Samurai. That's close. Anyway, the point is that this is stuff that anyone who's familiar with Westerns can sort of see a lot of the stuff where it's going. You've got, you know, like outlaws, you've got trekking over long distances, you've got nights out under the stars, you've got the threat of the natives. We'll get into that, and like, I really feel like there's a huge discussion we could have, a whole podcast episode about, yo, is this book racist? Hard to say.
Right, let's really kick things off. So one of our main three characters is Shy South. Geordie, what do you think about her?
So, it's hard to really get into why I like Shy, although I did, because it really comes back to the main themes of the text, and that main theme being the question of, can one really be redeemed? All three of the most important characters in the story seek redemption. Are any of them capable of it? Shy is great because she bounces off the other characters in the story, and I think that's true for all of them, really. Shai is a character who has done terrible things in her past. She wants to be a better person, but she is on the path to being a worse person if she carries on the way she does. Yeah, classic character trope in any fantasy, especially in any Western, very familiar. She also blends in well because she's absolutely like a black hat. You know, she was a bandit. Characters who are all over Westerns, normally as the bad guys.
Very much so. And I really enjoy the fact that I was worried when Shai was brought up that she used to have a troubled past, that this would feel a little bit too much like retreading the ground of Best Served Cold.
Sure, sure.
This person who, working off the land was really hard, so they turned to banditry.
Yeah.
And, you know, oh, ill-gotten gains are more easily got. What I really kind of like with Shai, though, is that I feel like Shai opened the story with so much more, like, regret for that past.
Absolutely, yeah. Shame is sort of her core defining feature. She's someone who's done terrible things in the past and believes she may have to do them again, but she's terribly appalled by what she did before.
I was about to say, like, and that's really nice. I know that sentence probably comes off.
It does.
A bit unfair.
It's a bit. I don't want to say anything like it's nice because I don't want to like be saying it's good because we're passing moral judgment. I think that's something you almost have to suspend to a certain extent in this story because it's a story about bad people who have done bad things and sometimes continue to do bad things and asking yourself, are they capable of redemption? Do we want to see them redeemed? Do we want to see them change? Or do we luxuriate in the way they get worse? I think we talked about this a lot in Best Served Cold. There's this dark fatalism to the story, which is incredibly entertaining to watch these characters just descend, to slip away. And you just hold up your hands and you go, c'est la vie, what can you do? The life they live is so dark and uncontrollable, there's nothing they can do but descend. And this story, it challenges that. And it does it in some really fascinating ways, despite how dark it is. And despite the fact it's the sequel to two books that were exactly about that dark fatalism. This is the book where you go, despite everything I've seen so far, I want these characters to get better. I think they can. I believe.
That is exactly why I think Shai's really stood out for me compared to previous Joe Combi main characters, because I really felt like, no, I want you to succeed. And you're trying so damn hard. Like, you never feel like it's an easy slide. Like, you are doing some bad things in this story, but it's made very clear how much it's hurting you and how much you're having to justify each step of the way why you're doing it. And it's a real struggle.
There's a thing we've said before about how Joe Abercrombie characters sometimes say one thing. Oh, sorry, they sometimes think a thing and then say something completely different. This story felt like it played that a tiny bit differently, because what tended to happen was people would think nice, sincere, kind things, and then they'd be a bit sour in the way they spoke. It was completely the opposite to what we'd seen before.
To put it another way, this is the first kind of main character that I've gone, oh, I actually think I wouldn't mind meeting you in the real
yeah.
world.
Shai could sort of like kick your butt a little bit, but you kind of would always understand, yeah, you've got my best interests at heart. You're not a bad, conniving person.
And she's also just, like, really brave in this story. She is going into a lot of danger for the sake of saving those
yes.
she cares
so
about.
So that's where we get the searches and the true grit part. You know, it's all about characters embarking on a quest for revenge and a quest for justice to go and get back what's right. And it's full of these plucky heroes, and we get that reflected in Shai. Shai isn't, you know, the former Confederate soldier who has to, you know, rescue his niece. She's the other character. She's the Texas Ranger. She's the girl who needs to get her father kill the man who killed her father in... I literally finished watching True Grit right before this episode. I can't believe I've already forgotten that girl's name.
Don't look at me.
Maddie. Maddie.
She also keeps, like, the rest of the characters on the right path. Whenever some of the other characters, I feel like, are starting to veer off into their kind of dark spirals, it's really nice to have Shai because she kind of helps hold people account. And not just in like a... this is a bit of a weird comparison. Like a Katara in Avatar The Last Airbender way.
I know what you mean.
Of being like...
Yes.
Being like, no, you must have hope. We must be good. Sometimes she holds them account by being like, you have been an ass.
Yes, exactly. And I was about to say that... What you're talking about there is the fact that Shai, as the like main female character, the other two main characters are both men. It's going against, you know, the fact that, yes, she's getting people back on the right path because she's kicking them up the rear and she's saying, stop acting out, get your head straight. Literally, with Temple, the way she forces him towards redemption is by holding him in financial slavery.
Should we talk about Temple? Our hero, everyone.
Yeah.
And our other main hero, Temple. Temple was a delight.
He's great.
I'm so happy with
him.
He's
a really weird character in a Joe Abercrombie because he should be the sniveling side character. Like, we see a lot of Temples in the heroes, you know. I guess you could say he's kind of close to Black Calder, that's it, sorry. Okay, he's like our version of Black Calder. He's smart, he's intelligent, but he has this strong moral core, and that's a sort of, like, sniveling side piece you'd see a lot in other stories. Like, someone who's blissfully naive up until the moment he's gonna get his throat cut by Monza, you know? But Temple sticks it out with a story. He represents this other, very different kind of redemption. He represents someone much like, say, Shai, or indeed Monza, is someone who chose the easy path. You mentioned at the start that there's this parallel between Monza and Shai, where, you know, they both start off as farmhands. They realize it's easier to become a killer than to be a farmer. Well, Monza lives with a little bit of regret, but Shai lives with a lot of regret. Temple
doesn't really have that.
Yes, Temple isn't a man of action. He's not a man of violence. But he also chooses the easy way because he's a coward. Because he runs away. Not just from, like, literally when a fight starts, he runs. Although that's literally true in almost several very funny ways in the story. But he forsakes his responsibilities. When we meet him,
yes,
he's a lawyer, but we go through this huge list of skills that he's been in the past, these different trades, because he's deserted all of them.
He strikes me as the person that would love to fall into kind of a bureaucratic desk job. Like, he does his paperwork, but he never wants to be the one that the buck stops with.
Exactly, that's true.
He's not responsible.
Yes, exactly. And I think you're really striking at something there. He wants to keep his hands clean. He doesn't want to have to make hard decisions.
And in many respects, his sort of arc is more about, like, knowing when to take that stand. And not just in a physical fight kind of way, but also in a when to finally stand up and not go with the flow.
Yes, exactly. His arc is about standing his ground. You know, literally, at the end of a story, it's about he stands up to his boss. He says no, which is, you know, like, talk about a fantasy, right? Like, who in the world doesn't want to say, no, I'm going to be my own man? But yet, it's about staking his claim. It's about saying, I'm going to stick at something. There's a refrain throughout the book about him choosing the easy way. And at the end, he chooses the hard way. And there's something so beautiful about that. How often in these stories do we root for someone to make the difficult choice? And with Temple, you're frustrated again and again as you watch him come so close and then take a backward step, but then another step forward, oh, but two more steps backwards, until you're finally ready for him to go through this really natural, organic growth. And the way in which that growth is paced out is fantastic. It really feels just good to see him make those incremental changes going forward.
It's a really nice section, actually, towards the middle of this book, where Temple goes on this great kind of path of growth, and he starts connecting with the other characters and committing to himself to a different lifestyle. He has a background in carpentry and architecture, and he's, like, building this store, or and he has this really nice section for him. But you kind of think, oh great, he's going for all this growth. But there's also the element of, oh, he's not being challenged at the moment. So you're kind of waiting for that challenge to come back up, and whether or not he's grown enough to then face it. And obviously, by the fact that I said it's in the midpoint of the book, spoilers, what happens there.
Exactly. And the great thing about it is that when we talk about evil, the other two main characters, Shai has a pull towards evil because she's out there, she wants revenge. What is she willing to do to get what she wants? There's a natural pull there. Well, get on to Lam, a pretty evil son of a bitch if there ever was one. But this flavor of evil is banal evil. It's looking the other way. It's doing nothing.
Which I love to be explored. In a weird way, I almost feel like it's the greater evil. Because I feel it's the...
Well,
this is going to sound bad.
Again,
it's
go to Lam.
It's the evil, though, which I think is exhibited by more people.
Of course, absolutely. In that way, Temple represents us much more than any of the other characters. He's far more real and present in our lives, in the small little injustices that we allow.
That's right. And just another quick point on that kind of being a character standing up bit. I really love that at the start of this book, he takes a stand, air quotes there, when he... because he doesn't agree with what his boss does.
Mm-hmm.
But in that, at the opening of the book, he defies it by, like, walking away and walking out on the evil being done. And at the end, it's the same kind of scenario, but he defies it by standing up to his boss. I kind of like that, because when he first runs away, I think a bit of him thinks he's being brave.
Exactly.
In that moment.
Yeah, he's saying, I'm making the strong choice. I'm walking away from this. I'm stepping aside. I won't have anything to do with this evil anymore. But in fact, what he's done, you know, he's abided it up till now. And all that's changed is that he can no longer tolerate his own being there. He won't do anything to actually stop it. He will insist that he's completely powerless to do anything about that. We actually find out at the end of the story is that he kind of had the power to stop his boss the whole time, though I don't think anyone could really have expected. I mean, the end of the story is so good, so we'll get onto that later, but...
Yeah, but that's what's great. So we've got these two types of, I don't know, redemption arcs going. The person that's felt the pull of evil but is repulsed by it and is now kicking people up the arse to be on the right track. And the other guy, he's a banal evil. He just lets evil kind of pass him by. He doesn't stand up to it. And when evil comes smashing in through his room, he jumps out the window. Talking of jumping out the window... Oh, you don't know that reference because you haven't read Last Argument of Kings. Anyway, let's talk about Lam.
So, this is the weird part of this, right? And when I say part of this, I mean our discussion of the last three books. Because I've never read any of the First Law original trilogy. I've only read the ones that you've introduced me to, Duncan, and we've only ever discussed them through that lens. This was the first time I was like, I feel like I'm missing something. I guess the only exception to that is when I was reading Best Served Cold and I was like, why the fuck are there vampires in this?
You're right, but up till now, this standalone trilogy of standalones, you might have missed tiny pieces of world building, but there was never anything that I think you would lose a character arc or certainly not the plot at play.
Yeah, even I knew Cole who Shivers, Black Dow was.
Yeah. They told you everything you need to know. Cole Shivers, I feel like they told you everything you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much all of the characters actually in the heroes were in the First Law trilogy, but they were side characters, and you get what their character's about in that conflict. But Lam, let me tell everyone about Lam. Lam is just the soft-centered stepfather mm-hmm. to Shai and the kids. He arrived on the farm, he looked after their ailing mother, and when she passed away, Lam was just there for them. He never picked a fight. He was a coward, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
I calls him a coward all throughout the opening. He just would rather get beaten up on than stand up for himself. But he's caring. When they fall out of the tree as a kid, he picked them up and took them back to the farmhouse. Strong, reliable, cowardly Lam.
The twist in this story is probably the most obvious thing I've ever seen coming.
It is. It's massive. Even before, I'll be honest, I didn't know who Lam was immediately, but I knew what they were going to do with Lam. In fact, I actually knew what they're going to do, Lamb, because I'd seen another Western show.
Yeah, sure.
Sort of a Western. It's a sci-fi Western that if you've ever watched Trigun, it's the same character.
I haven't seen Trigun, but you're right. Obviously, there's a very stock character of like this unassuming gentle giant who turns out to have a dark past. It's all over the place. And more than that, like, I think anyone can see, even if you haven't read the blurb, when he's overemphasized, when you overemphasize how gentle and weak Lam is, you get the sense there's obviously a lot more going on there. And when they mention his gloved hand, singular, you're like, oh, I fucking know who this is.
So, Geordie, what was it like meeting the Bloody Nine?
It was an interesting experience. So I mentioned last, when we did our episode on the heroes, you asked me to basically, who do I think the Bloody Nine is? And I gave this description, and I basically described a character somewhere between Guts and Shy. I described him as a character who was sort of stuck in a cycle of violence, but he wasn't really capable of breaking. And that was, I think that's, as you said, yeah, that's pretty good. I think I was really missing one element, an element that I really don't think had ever been adequately explained to me. I didn't realize that he was as mad as a bag of cats.
Yes, just to be clear, everyone, by the way, Lam is revealed, although not explicitly in text, to be the character of the Bloody Nine, or Logan Ninefingers.
The name is never said. It's never said in the entire book.
Which, by the way, I love. And there is even a section of people who are like, so how do we really know? And the vast majority of people going, it's so obvious. Do you, they,
yeah, literally, Joe, I mean, the last chapter, even if you believe that for a second, the last chapter, it's literally confirmed.
So, he's mad.
Yeah.
A little bit.
He's fucking psycho. And like, in even a more of a like, you know, damaged vet way, like a really damaged vet way, string of human ears, Vietnam vet way.
I don't know why I'm so excited right now. Yes, he is. And this all kind of plays into his character, the fact that he knows this is what's in him. And it's actually made clear in the First Law trilogy, like, this isn't quite a direct response of all of his experiences. He's been the Bloody Nine throughout his entire career. Like, this has been a consistent factor to this guy.
There's this stock character. You see it all the time. And especially shows up in, like, lone wolf and cub style stories. But if you don't know, that's the story where you have a gruff old badass looking after a kid who they slowly start to come to terms with and emotionally connect to. It's your Joels from The Last of Us. It's your Kratos is from the God of War reboot. It's Gabriel from the Empire of the Vampire. Geralt, blah, blah, blah. They're all over the place. And there's this theme that runs throughout Wolverine 2. It's like, I'm a bad guy who's done bad things, you know?
But deep down, I am just a lovable teddy bear. And you can cuddle up to me eventually.
Exactly. That's all about an icy exterior being melted away to reveal a soft, soft core. This is the first time I've ever read a book or watched a movie and someone has said, I'm a bad, bad man. And I've gone, oh, wow, you are. You're a bad, bad guy.
I love it so much. This truly, I think, I've never known a character who really gets to that point where you're thinking, oh, but deep down, like even Kratos, a character that does horrible things in the original trilogy, like they really turn him around in the new games, that you're like, no, he's a dad, he's got that soft core. With the Bloody Nine, by the way, we have POVs, we know what he's thinking. I really finish this going, gosh, deep down, when we actually get right to the center of you are bad. You have some niceties on the exterior, but you work hard to keep that up. But, like, at the core, that is dark. And
yes,
I love
and
it.
And yes, it's true. This is the character of the book where it really stretches your credulity to say, can he redeem himself? Can he settle down? Can he be at peace? And that's the one thing. And you hanker for it in the end, much like you do in something like, say, Unforgiven. You're encountering a man who's done bad things, hopefully mostly to bad people. But at the end, you're like, yes, come on, do it, change, be good. And yeah, one of the great dramas throughout is, can he stick to it? Can he walk the line? Is he going to fall off?
It also, I think, when you meet this character in this book, it really shines another light on some of the events of the heroes. Because...
Go ahead.
One of the things that kind of plays in the heroes is, and in the first trilogy, is that the Bloody Nine was the one that actually killed Bethod and was preparing to take the throne. Well, not the throne, become King of the North and have an actual throne. And I think you really realise when you get to know the Bloody Nine, as you do, how... all those awful characters you met in the heroes, genuinely, all were better candidates than this guy. Like, Black Dow did probably the right, completely the right thing to throw a coup and get this guy gone.
You're completely right. That's the thing. I always had the impression, and this is, again, why I sort of regretted for the first time that I hadn't read the original trilogy, was like, I felt like I could have had a better experience of... knowing Black Dow in comparison to the Bloody Nine and Lamb, by reading this book, I felt like I was missing it on emotional context. Like in this, he like says he doesn't really begrudge the fact that like he lost his crown or his necklace, as it were. And I'm like, I really wish I got to experience that. Like, why did you do it in the first place? I don't know. I know there was a wizard involved, but I don't know why.
Oh, Geordie, there's one way to find out.
Yeah, but I got a lot of stuff to read, man.
That's quite fair enough. And that's really his arc. And I really enjoy the fact that, and skipping a bit kind of further in the story, it's nice the fact that we've got all these characters and you want all of them to improve. And to throw us one that you're like, I don't know if you are going to be redeemed. And also to throw one at me that as a reader, I'm like, I don't know if you should be redeemed.
Are you referring to Lam there, or are you referring to Koska?
I quite like the fact that I think it works for both.
Yeah, this is the really fascinating part, and I think it's part of what makes the character arcs really work in this, which is that Koska, from Best Served Cold, shows back up as an important character, kind of the main villain of the story, despite the fact he was one of the heroes with, like, is there such a thing as an opposite of a capital letter in subtext? H.
Yeah, you know, that works.
Hero, like of the first book in this trilogy, he's completely reprehensible, and he was no angel in that first book, but he saved Monza's life. And he took in orphans, and he got revenge on people who'd wronged him. But in this one, he's just an animal.
He is, and there is a bit of me that felt that I kind of missed a beat in his character. He wasn't unrecognisable at all, but I definitely feel like, oh, you have descended since I last saw you. You went very high to begin with.
No doubt that's true. He has literally just gotten worse as a person. He's older, he's more embittered, and the troubling thing about it is that he just acts the exact same. The way he talks, the jovial nature of it. I also think that a part of my experience here was that, basically, I own all three books, but my copy of Red Country is in a cardboard box somewhere in Suffolk. And I couldn't find it, so I had to listen to this on Spotify using its audiobook. And as a result, for the first time, the story was read to me, and I wasn't reading characters with their voices in my head. And it just so happens that the narrator gave Koska a much older man's voice than I was used to, where I always thought him as kind of like spry and jolly in an almost Father Christmas kind of way. But the fact he sounded kind of old and worn down, it really added to this sense that he was, that he had changed and been, you know, he'd been reduced in some way.
I think there's definitely an element coming off the Best Served Cold. Best Served Cold, the character art for Nico Costa is that he's very much just ride the wave. And that's the attitude he projects. And he says to his companion, Friendly, that's what we're going to do. It's a violent world. Let's just see where it takes us. And I think what I find quite interesting is you can really see in this book, which, by the way, in universe is set, I believe it's 10 or 11 years after the events of Best Served Cold. We've had quite the time jump here. That it's like, if you're just riding the wave, how do you ever get off? Like, Kosta doesn't have a retirement plan. He's just like, I just keep going. And every time he does something evil, I get the sense that he must have just been like, gets more numb and more numb. And the jokes become thicker and faster so that he can just sort of deal with it.
It's kind of incredible that the person who experiences the most emotional growth in Kosta's band, aside from Temple, is Friendly. And it literally just comes down to a scene. Friendly, he always just does what he's told. Kosta tells him, kill one of the children hostages. And Friendly says, I'd prefer not to. And I've never heard Friendly ever go, I don't want to do that, man.
I love how that equates to Big Character Arc. This guy's...
Yeah, but it's true.
We don't get any time in Friendly's head in this book. Compared to Best Served Cold.
Miss it though.
I do miss it. And obviously, Friendly's character, there's a lot of baggage there, but the fact that even he's getting to this point of like, do we have to keep doing evil? And I really like that actually, because we get that little moment, because we're not in his head. You're like, oh my god, is every bloke in Kosta's band sort of playing out the same argument that like Temple goes through? They're just 80 steps behind. Or a couple of, you know, continents distance. In terms of like, all of them are like, oh, it's a bad thing, but it's the job.
There is something to be said about the monstrousness of a lot of the characters in this story. The stories are full of these complex, damaged characters. And that's all the books in this trilogy. No one is bad to be bad. But then you do get these background characters. You have men like the ones who follow Kosta, who will just pillage and kill without any thought, completely guided by greed, with the absolute basest, lowest feelings. And these characters don't get characterization. And there isn't a lot done to be said, why do they act like this? What makes their behavior different from these characters who aren't in any way all good, who aren't irredeemable, who aren't incorruptible by any stretch, but their, their darkness has an explanation. And it's a lot more cavalier in its presentation of human darkness. Obviously, I don't need any convincing that human beings are capable of being greedy and evil and doing immoral things. And I think the main reason that he doesn't take the time to explore is that he really just wants to hold him in contrast to the so-called savages that appear in the story.
Oh, I think that's a really good point. And I'll say a very nice transition. So let's talk about the... air quotes again, savages in the story. Obviously, these are the stand-ins for the, is it correct, Native American tribes.
Well, you can say Native American, you can say Indian. It's some people who, some Indian people in America don't like the word Native American because it says, they say, well, we're not American. You know, we're the people who live here. Indian is incorrect, but so is the word American. So, you know. And, like, the government body that looks, you know, takes care of them is the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Okay, then. Well, this is the stand-in for them. And, Geordie, we've seen an author before write a stand-in for the Indian population of the Americas. Obviously, our favourite Robert E. Howard had his stand-in.
Yes.
Called The Picts.
Yes, it's one of the most racist stories I've ever read.
And that's saying something, because we have read Lovecraft. Now, I'm just going to say, I think Joe Abercrombie tackled this much better than Robert E. Howard does.
No question is better. Is it good? I'm in two minds. He's doing a lot of the steps to say, to distance himself from saying, yeah, these are my engines, you know. He's, for one thing, ironically enough, they're quite Pictish. You know, they have red hair. The ghosts, that's the group they're called. Like, they're not described as looking Native American. They don't have black hair. They don't have dark skin. They have, like, painted faces. But in its own way, you could sort of say, well, that sounds almost more like a Roman description of finding ancient Britons, right? So in that way, the savage people, he's not coding them as being Native American. But then again, there's other stuff which absolutely is coded. Like, they take ears as opposed to taking scalps. That's a, you know, like a dark historical image that, you know, which perpetuates to this day in media surrounding the Old West and European expansion.
And he's still, despite kind of attempts to characterize the ghosts throughout the story, they're still fulfilling the same role.
That's right.
They're the other. They're the enemy, and our characters, part of the colonial expansion from the near country, where our characters begin, to the far country, excellent naming, where they travel to, it's all, you know, we're still on their side. These are a threat to our, put my arms out here, you know, our band of adventurers.
Right, yes. And obviously, what I mentioned with the mercenaries, what are they called? The Brotherhood of the Generous Hand?
Oh, something to that tune.
Yeah, something deeply ironic. Obviously, I've said those characters are far, far more violent and greedy and sinful than any of the, like, native characters who appear in this. And that's, like, I think a deliberate contrast. He's trying to show, especially, the contrast between the mercenaries and the dragon people. And so once again, we have these two different groups. And I think, again, he's tried to distance himself from the racist attachments of making the savage characters into his scapegoats, into his others to be conquered and to be thwarted. Because he said, okay, there are distinct groups. Yes, there are the ghosts. Oh, and one more thing. This is a classic trope, and it's something he's tried to do to distance himself from it, but I actually think he's accidentally stumbled into kind of a racist stereotype, which is that Shy is part ghost. And I think in that way he's saying, okay, well, I've got a main character who's part ghost, so, you know, like, it's not an us versus them thing. Except I don't really feel like he's understood that there's this trope that appears in a lot of fiction that includes Native Americans, where it says, where, like, the wildness is diluted by them being, like, half-blooded.
This is Geordie from the future jumping in with an awful cold whilst editing the episode to say that something else that occurred to me later is that the character in The Searchers, Martin, the sidekick to the main character, Ethan, who's going on the hunt for his niece, he's a quarter Cherokee, and in that way, he fills the same role as Shy in this story, as the sort of mediating force to the vengeful and kind of crazy Ethan. So yeah, that's another parallel and a reason why she's part ghost.
Ooh, that's not a good one.
Yeah, sorry, I talked for a while.
No, but you could have a lot more kind of knowledge on this. I am not particularly clued up from a historical point of view on the reality of the expansion west on the American continent.
Yes, and I'm saying that a lot of the stuff I'm drawing from here is because I did do a course when I was living in America on Native American literature, and that idea of the hero of a story being half-blooded, and that sort of having a civilizing effect on them, that's a trope which I recognize, which I probably wouldn't have recognized otherwise.
And I do like there's an aspect to them. I definitely feel like the overarching message, well, one of the overarching messages is that, like, the expanding civilization is not a positive force. When we get to the towns out east in the far country, I think they're traveling east.
I can't remember. I think it is, yeah.
Flip that around. You know, this isn't necessarily as a very positive thing. I think, you know, there's definitely a sense of sympathy being built up to the native population, by and large. But I don't think they're really given enough full character. And ultimately, the plot isn't about them. And I feel like if you really wanted to tackle that, it needs to be
And I think he didn't really want to tackle it. I think that's the thing. He deliberately sort of underplayed it in order to, like, distract. And I think that's why the dragon people are made distinct. There are the ghosts, and then there are the dragon people. And the dragon people are set up in a way somewhat similar to, like, Bone Tomahawk. Have you seen that film, Dunk?
I have not.
Pretty good. Can't recommend. Very gross. In that story, it floats into this very racist territory by saying there's this monstrous group of Indians out there who are abducting people. Now, that's the other thing. The abductions in the story are really tied to Native Americans in a historical and historical fiction sense. Like, when I was doing American studies, some of the earliest fictions we looked at were stories written by a woman who got kidnapped by a group of Native Americans.
I was referring to the narrative of the life of Mrs. Mary Jemison. She was a woman captured as a child in 1755, and she later wrote a story about her experiences being, you know, made a part of the Seneca tribe, and it basically invented, like, a genre called captivity fiction, which is a really big deal in historical American literature.
And, like, that's a thing that it did happen, but it was really amped up in people's understanding of Indians, and it was used as this propagandistic tool to say, oh, they're wicked. They take our people and they indoctrinate them. That's why they need to be taken and they need to be indoctrinated back. So the fact that the children of the start of the story are taken and abducted, yes, not by the native analogues, not by the dragon people, but by, like, but by white men. I assume they're white, you know, people from the near country. That's significant. Not only is it, like, setting up to, like, be similar to The Searchers, which is about that. It's about a little girl who's abducted by Indians. But it's also saying, yeah, but they're not the ones actually doing it, right? They just buy them at the end. Like, they do the last part of a transaction. And hey, they're not even so bad.
And that really just plays into what you said earlier. It's this idea that this is such complicated and multifaceted thing that needs to be unpacked and explored. And I want that to happen. But at the same time, Joe Abercrombie, he doesn't want to, I don't think at least, deeply explore the realities of the expansion west in America. He wants to play with westerns and the tropes.
Exactly.
And it's a thing where, and you're right, I think it's the right decision for what he was trying to do. And I almost,
for the most part, yes,
can't fault him for what he was trying to do, because I still enjoy, you know, I do enjoy westerns. It's a fun genre. And I don't want to say I want the whole genre kind of dragged down because he wants to include some of these elements. But you're right. He just didn't quite spin it well enough or separate it out enough or explore it. There's just something there. I'm like, okay, there's some really deep, uncomfortable, real world connotations going on here.
Right.
And I almost can't blame you, Joe Abercrombie, for not beautifully unpacking this and still giving me my fun adventure story, because, heaven forbid, I have no idea how you would. No clue. Like, it might be an impossible ask. But it's a shame that it's there, and it was something that kind of I noted and did detract a little bit from the experience for me.
We're both fans of pulp fiction, and like pulp fiction written in the 20s and 30s. So we're very used to having to wade through weird, racist, colonialist stuff. Like, our last episode was on Gibbet Hill, and that is probably the most, like, colonialist story we've ever read, because it's about otherness and strangeness of other places incurring into homeland Britain, which is also what Dracula's about.
And I also don't want it to seem, by the way, that I'm critiquing Joe Abercrombie because he tried to make it better or that he tried to handle it.
No, of course not. Yes, it's not like it's an embarrassing attempt. I agree with Duncan. I think a lot of the choices are apt and good choices, aside from that one about the half-blood thing. That's just a fumble. It's just an L. But we have the experience of being unable to say we can't do away with a whole genre because it has bad elements. I don't think we shouldn't tell Westerns. We shouldn't just cancel them out and say, no more, we're done, put it to rest. Because they are fun. And I feel like, yes, he is doing a lot of the legwork to try and tell a non-racist version of that story. If, you know, if I show this to a friend who is Cherokee and they said, Geordie, I'm not going to read this book, I think it's kind of like a lot of the racist stuff I've read before, I'm not going to argue that person. I'm not going to try and say, well, actually, no, I wouldn't. But I think it's a good book.
And it's really worth saying.
And I feel like he's doing it as much as he can to try and distance himself while still making a fun Western.
His heart is entirely in the right place. I just think the task that he sort of set himself is so momentally challenging. I don't know how else you could possibly both address the issues and still pull off the same type of story that he wants to focus on telling.
All right, I think we've said everything we can about that.
Absolutely. Let's get on to some of the other trophy sections, because in many respects, although this story isn't nearly as episodic as Best Served Cold was, which is very literally cut up in several ways. This one does have sections, to be fair, so it is cut up, but I really feel like we get a nice, you know, it opens with the searchers, the burning farmhouse, the initial chase, that fight with Lam, where Lam first loses it, and you go, oh, it's the bloody nine. but then what we fall into is the next section, it's the caravan.
Yes, Miller's Crossing.
I've said Miller's Crossing like 4 times now. That's very embarrassing. That's not the movie I was referring to. I was referring to Meek's Cutoff. Miller's Crossing is a neo-noir gangster movie, which I haven't seen, so... oof, embarrassing.
The Oregon Trail. And you're right, it's really different because it slows way down.
This is part of that kind of chase. And the thing is, it is still a chase, but the characters know, you know, there's nothing they can do. The only way to cross the far country is part of these grand caravans. This is the section where we kind of meet the expanded cast. It's where Temple meets up with Shy for the first time. And we get a lot of interesting characters, some a little bit tropey. Dab Sweet, I loved. He's the famous scout of the far country, and he's the man with the long tails have far exceeded what he ever was, but he still kind of leans into them a little bit, still has to be like, I didn't actually fight a bear with my bare hands. Please don't ask me to do that.
Dab's so fun. He's great, because, you're right, he is such a familiar character. The fact you get to throw someone in there like that, you know, this, I was about to say Wild Bill Hickok, but not him, the other one. You know his name, you talked about him in our, Sutter Knife episode. Coonskin Cap.
If you say so.
Yes, Duncan, he died at the fucking...
Oh, Davy Crockett!
Yes, Davy Crockett.
I love it, he died at the, and I'm like, yeah, the Alamo, got it.
Yeah. Yeah, so you've got a Davy Crockett character. You've got his ghost sidekick. He expects better of him, and again wants him to sort of be a better man, redeem himself. You've got really fun, strange character. I expected to dislike this, but I really liked Mahood. I just really liked him whenever he was on the page.
I mean,
he's just nice. It's nice to see him get into arguments with people about the guy who's fastidious about money and is trying to crack deals and has some charm about him. I really enjoyed scenes where it was just him and Temple talking, and later down the line, he's trying to crack a deal with Temple, and Temple starts bidding back and he's like, ah, you've been spending too much time with Shy. She's taught you how to negotiate.
I think what I quite enjoy is that when we have these very dark path, melodramatic kind of characters, I think we're going slightly melodramatic, in a kind of our main trio, it's nice to have these slightly more normal people going on. They're still a bit of archetypes. They're still played out. They're still larger than life characters, but they don't feel, they're not tortured souls. They've had some rough bits. Yeah, they've had some ups and downs, but they're not agonizing in life. They're just trying to crack on with it.
And it's really funny how in the end, it almost feels like a sort of a bit of panache, a bit of flourish at the end, where in the last couple of chapters, Joe Abercrombie has these characters who were introduced in this section, but were really background minor characters, all suddenly pop up one by one and be important. You've got this family who seem completely extraneous, and at the last minute they're important because the children are used as hostages. You've got this, very sad sack has-been actor who hilariously saves the day in one of the best scenes in any of this trilogy so far. And you got this guy, you know, from the start, from the first movie, is introduced, like, this guy's gonna be a traitor, but they hold off on that for so long, you literally forget he exists, and then he pops up and is like, oh, this fucking guy, of course!
It's really nicely done. I love the fact there's a character in this. By the way, this is a subplot which I have actually forgotten until this moment. There's the guy who's travelling with his niece, and he covers his arms because, oh, what's going on? And there's this whole subplot about these rebels in the near country, and their leader's, like, gone missing, and they're trying to track him down. And you're like, it's him, it's this guy, he's undercover, and that the rebels, like, tattoo themselves with slogans about down with the Union. And that's why the Niko Koska, he's travelling out to the far country to hunt down this guy, with, and he's burning villages on the way, and it's this whole thing that could be a story in of itself. And it's just like this side piece to what our characters are trying to do.
It's great. It's true. It's, and the way it's like wrapped up in the end is such a nice little, like, okay, sure, fine, all right, that's funny. I feel like this is Joe Abercrombie. He's written the heroes, and people are like, I cannot believe how good this book is. And he's just feeling so confident, but he's just like, yeah, I'm just gonna go out, and you can feel he's just on a roll.
So talking of rolling on then, so I said, we've just praised this whole cavern, and it's a bit of a slow burn. We get some introduction of the ghost in this section. That's one of the kind of the things that they come up against, one of the obstacles on their journey. But eventually they kind of pull in to this town in the far country. And then...
Yes, so we've gone from the searchers, we've done Miller's Crossing and the Oregon Trail, and now we're doing Deadwood.
I was going to say A Fistful of Dollars.
Yeah, it's kind of also The Fistful of Dollars, but I think the main difference there is that The Fistful of Dollars takes place in a town that's like, obviously there's two rival crime gangs, like splitting the town in part. That's The Fistful of Dollars part. But this town is actually a functioning society, and that's the Deadwood part. Because Deadwood is about a savage, uncontrollable place turning into society.
This whole section, once again, kind of made me forget that there was a larger plot. Like, we stop in this town for a good bit. We're not following the children anymore. Like, this is in the middle of the story. And I genuinely got into my head, like, is this it? Is this the story again? Because this is a story. This has a beginning. There's complications. There's a climax. There's a twist.
It's true.
All contained in this small town. So, in this section, like Jordy alluded to, there's two rival families. Not about rival families, sorry. There's two rival characters. You've got the official mayor of the town, a very genteel woman, and you've got sort of the guy running the crime ring called, I think, Papa Ring.
Yes, Papa Ring.
That's town's right. Called Crease, by the way. And it's all come down to the fact they've gone, right, we're not going to stop shooting at each other across town. You're going to pick a champion, I'm going to pick a champion, and whoever wins, the other one just walks away. I love this fight.
Yeah, and this is like, it's the take on the standoff, you know, the quick draw. There's going to be a duel. And surprisingly enough, like, you kind of expect it to be like, you know, sword and board, fighting in the circle. Like, is always alluded to in these stories. That's how, like, the Bloody Nine has done his work. It's kind of surprising that it's actually like a bare-knuckle boxing match. Like, that's what's going to decide the whole thing.
True. I think maybe, I don't know if that's alluding to another element of pulp. Boxing pulps were quite popular. Maybe that leans into the Western element. I don't know enough historical nature to really comment. Maybe boxing was a big sport at the time.
Really, it ought to be like two guys with a flat bow. Because those are all over this story. You know, they say, ready, set, crank! And then they each spend 30 seconds going, arr! And whirring up their crossbow to shoot each other.
Oh, that would just be... That would actually be a great scene. I love the idea. And like our main hero, they're cranking away. But the villain character, he gets there first. He pulls up, he fires. And like, if this was like the Bloody Nine, he would just tank the shot. And then to kill him. Like, that would be the scene. But instead, we've got this really cool setup. Talk about like the Bloody Nine and his characterization. The Bloody Nine has such a John Wick about him.
Yes, very apt comparison. And more so John Wick than anyone else. Like, John Wick is a character who's like, oh, he was out of the game and now he's dragged back in. Again, that's the trope we talked about before. You know, I'm a bad man, I've done bad things.
Ooh, but the thing about John Wick that I was really
so much more convincing
is that in this scene we've got, it's all about other people just talking him up and then completely, use the phrase, shitting the bed when they go, oh crap, I've got to go up against him. Oh no.
Yes, that's true. And I think that's something that's been so wonderful about this trilogy so far, is the reputation which the Blade Nine has is so convincing that even though I've never seen him in action up to now, enough people have talked about him in this awe-inspired and terrified way that I'm like, yes, I believe that he's going to be a serious, serious badass when the time comes. Here's my question to you, Duncan. Is he a little too badass?
Is the Bloody Nine too badass?
Because I never, until the very, very, very end, I was never convinced he was going to lose.
So, that's actually a good question. I will be honest, when I read the original First Law trilogy, I actually walked away from that trilogy with the idea, it's never confirmed, it's not confirmed in text at all. I wouldn't even use the word alluded. This is just my own impression. This is what I put on the story. I always thought that the Bloody Nine, it's like, is it almost magical? Like, is there something more? I was expecting a bit of a reveal at one point in his characterization where they go, ah, he taps some deeper power, or like the Bloody Nine is some sort of demonic, I don't know, berserk style extra beast that kind of possesses him. And that never is revealed. It is, far as you can tell from the text, just his character.
Right. There's a thing which I saw once, and I was just glancing through, it got recommended to me. It was a post from r/martial arts, people talking about martial arts, and they were talking about, as they always do, they were comparing different fighters and different fighting styles. And the top comment there has just stuck with me, and it's not any sage wisdom, which is just that they said, it doesn't really matter who's fighting, because the person who typically wins is the one who wants to hurt the other person more. Violence is what wins fights. And I think that really comes down to it. That, yes, the Bloody Nine is really good at fighting because it's all he's ever done. Lots of people in this story are good at fighting. The thing that sets him apart is he's just more capable of being violent than other people. And so he wins.
It almost reminds me a little bit about, and this might sound absolutely ridiculous, but in the first book, like, the Bloody Nine is picked out because he was the most capable. That's one of the reasons why he is singled out in that story. And there's a quote that's just popped into my head by British comedian David Mitchell. Now, he's talking about Shakespeare.
Okay.
But I think it applies to this character. And he makes a thing of a comment about Shakespeare where he's like, someone has to be the best at writing. Like, you give people in the world, you rank them, one guy's going to be at the top. And it just so happens, it's Shakespeare. And in this world, one guy just happens, you know, if you've got all the fighters, put them in a line, one guy is going to be the top. And it just so happens, it's the Bloody Nine, hence why he's the main, one of the main characters.
Yeah, it's literally, it's much like with John Wick. It's just like, it's just really unfortunate you happen to run into this guy's house. Like, it's just really bad luck.
And maybe there's an element of suspension of disbelief, definitely. I think that's what you're kind of calling out. You're like, oh, it seems a bit too much, or
no,
it was taking the wind out of the sails for me. For me, I'm just like, I get it. I'm happy that it is, though, because ultimately, I wouldn't be reading a story about someone less who wasn't the Bloody Nine in this case.
I think there could be some more intensity. He could just get a little bit more battered up in his fight against Glamour, for example, who is, like, set up to be like, yeah, this guy has never lost a fight before, period. Like, I mean, I guess against Gorst. Yeah, I guess when you've had a guy who's been beaten up by Gorst, maybe you're like, okay, he's not the most badass guy in the world. But the point is that, like, yeah, he's hardcore, he's really bad, he's younger than Lam, like, he's literally larger than him, but there's never any doubt that Lam's gonna win. None. When he fights against this guy who's supposed to be a total badass later, you're like, yeah, but he's going to win. There is one exception to this, but I think it's how we end the episode. because it's one hell of an ending to this book.
Can I just make one tiny little point on that? I think there's also an element in this scene where it actually speaks to the power of reputation. One of the reasons why Golden Glamour loses this fight, at least from my opinion, is that he goes into it already terrified. No?
He figures out who he is in the middle of the fight.
Okay, fair enough.
And but that's a point in your favour too. He goes into it cautious because he's world weary, in a similar way to what Lam is, but he loses right after he figures out who he is. Like, he shows him his missing finger and he says, "Guess who I am?" And he's like, "Oh, fuck." And then he loses. And it sort of happens, like, he describes, like, the aftermath more than anything, but Lam doesn't just kill him, he rips him apart.
Yes. See earlier when we said that Lam is a bad person deep down.
Yes, the blade itself. I want to jump ahead to beyond the fight. That was something that the characters had to get to in order to achieve their goal. The mayor said, "I will give you the guy who took your siblings if you fight for me." They fight for her, and she gets the guy gets handed over. And then Koska shows up and ruins everything. But quickly moving beyond that, everything. He ruins Temple's character arc. He ruins their plans for revenge for a bit because he says, "Yeah, this guy can actually live because I need him." But the point is that Koska is after gold. It turns out that these dragon people who've abducted children, they're the ones who have a lot of gold. So he's like, "Well, I'm just going to pretend that they are actually rebels, so I have a reason to go hunt them. And sure, Lam can come too, who cares?"
I quite like this bit. All our characters were getting together. Big old showdown.
I like it too. Yeah, it's good. Should we briefly go over the dragon people?
I think so. I think a lot of what's to talk about, then we maybe have kind of covered when we did talk about the ghosts and their relationship. The main thing to talk about the dragon people in specific, firstly, they're not descendant for dragons. They're not dragonborns. They are...
So disappointing.
I know. They're a group of people who have a deep connection to the land up in these mountains. They have their own personal religion, and they are trying to preserve their culture because they believe eventually the dragon will reawaken, and on that day they will reclaim the world.
It's so... Speaking as someone who has not read much of... who knows nothing about the original trilogy... But I do have a sense that they're a little bit more magical than the sequel series, because I know a character in them is supposed to be a wizard, but I don't really know what that means. And someone talked about, and Shivers said, "I saw a man summon fog." And I'm like, did you? There are eaters. I know that they're there. So I'm like, is there going to be a dragon? I feel like I don't have enough context to definitively know whether or not that's the case. Duncan, did a little part of you believe that there was going to be a dragon?
Yeah, a bit of me really did. I was very much expecting that. Okay, this is going to sound absolutely left field, and you'll be like, "Duncan, why again? Like, do you have to keep referencing the same author and character? I'm sorry, it's what I do, it's my shtick." But Robert Jordan actually had a very similar plot in his novel Conan the Magnificent, where someone gets captured by a cult of people, taken up into the mountains, our main hero goes out to rescue them. And there is a drake, as called in that story, that they are trying to reawaken to lead them to victory. Anyway, sorry, just want to bring that up. But yes, I thought there could be a dragon.
There's other Conan stories that have dragons. They just so happen to be T-Rexes.
And I genuinely was like, how would this be played? I wouldn't have been surprised if it was going to allude to the fact that there used to be dragons in this world, or there was a creature that wouldn't be quite what we traditionally consider a dragon, but it would be dragon-like. But that's not what we get, and I was quite surprised by what's revealed in this scene.
Yeah, so these people keep talking about the Maker. Duncan, am I missing context here? Do you know who the Maker is?
No, not really. We in the previous trilogy, we get alluded to a character who... So all the individuals who are moving the chess pieces at the top level, you meet the character, the wizard characters in the heroes.
Baez.
Yes. His master, I'm surmising, may have been at that next level. I don't know if he is the maker or that was what the tier above them are, but that tier above him are all gone. So it's alluded to, but it's nothing's explicit. We don't know the deep history of this world.
There are these swords. There are special swords that are very good, but I don't know why they're good. Are they made of Valyrian steel? Can they kill White Walkers?
I mean, effectively, yeah. They're just good. Don't worry.
Okay, so they raid these people. For some reason, I love the fact that they say something about the land poisons them and they can't have children of their own, so they have to abduct children. And at that point, I'm like, okay, is it because they have, like, uranium poisoning or something? Like, is there something here that's, like, making them sterile? Why? And that's never answered, and it fascinates me. This is the bit. This is a weird thing to draw from. This feels like something Christopher Paolini would write. He's constantly, like, alluding to the fact that real-world physics exists in his world, but the characters don't understand it because they only understand magic. So, like, there's an island where there is radiation poisoning because someone basically turned themselves into a nuke. And like, the characters don't know what radiation poisoning is. And they see mutations, and they don't know why there are mutations. And I love that. And I'm like, is that happening here? And I don't know, because he doesn't tell me. And now I want to read the next books to see if I'm going to get some fucking answers.
It's definitely the same type. You reference Christopher Paolini. I would say Mark Lawrence does another similar thing where he sets up very traditionally fantasy looking worlds on the surface and then really reveals sort of a bit more of a technology advanced past.
Yeah, but that's because those are like sci-fi books. I'm talking about just like real world physics, you know?
True, but I think what Joe Abercrombie's going for is more aligned to Mark Lawrence. I think there's something in this which is hinting at something more sci-fi and we're not fully getting it. And there's definitely too much magic going on to say real world physics. Those flesh eater things are basically
vampires. Yeah.
Vampire superheroes.
I don't think it's okay, so what we're getting at here is that there's an impression that there was like a precursor civilization that fell apart. And that could be sci-fi. And there's a reason to think that it might be. But it also could just be fantasy. I think it's fantasy. It's just there was a more sophisticated society that probably had a better understanding of magic. I think that magic is probably magic, not science. But the reason why you might think it's science is that the dragon which appears is a robot.
It's a mechanical or some description. I first thought maybe it was they're trying to describe some sort of like tank-like structure. But I think it is more of like a mechanical.
I think it's an automaton. It's an like a construct. A wizard once could bring this dragon to life. Maybe it has a fucking plutonium core and that's why they can't have babies.
It's not explained. I don't have the answers. How did you find it work for this story? I love the fact that it's like, we're on this Western, but there's still this deeper fantasy world sitting there. It's just not part of driving our plot at right now.
We need more Western fantasies. We got adjacent to it with like the gunpowder mage stuff because it's like, you know, you're introducing black powder to fantasy and that's cool and interesting. And I bet there's some like more Western elements in like his novellas or something.
Oh, Dordy, we will get there one day in the long, long distance future. We'll get to Mistborn Era 2.
Oh yeah, Mistborn Era 2, of course. I knew you were going to bring that up.
That's my go-to example. It's a fantastic work on this. But you're right, we'd love to see more. I think this was a nice element to put at the end of this sort of adventure. Like, they've travelled all this long way, and what are they confronted with? Well, they get the kids back, and it's just another mystery. And our characters don't hang around to solve it.
They're not interested. And, oh my god, I've been excited all episode to get to this. I'm sorry I keep interrupting you, Duncan, but there's so many cracking lines in this story. This one is my favourite. This one is my favourite by far. Koska, his men have stormed the dragon people's place. Lam has killed their leader. And as he lies dying underneath the dragon, he's begging them, please, don't take the gold and don't harm the dragon, because it will awaken soon, and that's what we've been striving for. And Koska gives this speech, and it's a speech all about colonialism. It's about manifest destiny. And it's about the slow encroach of tomorrow and how everything that is grand and rich and beautiful is going to be replaced by mundanity. And it's a long quote, so I won't read the whole thing. But it's basically about how you can't hold back the future. Progress is going to come stampeding through and there's nothing we can do. But there is just this line. You can wish it were not so. I wish it were not so. But it is so. I tire of lost causes. The time of men like me is passing. The time of men like you? So long past, it might as well have never been.
Oh.
It's so good.
Sick burn.
Joe Abercrombie. What a writer. I think in this story, more than any of the others, he's just proved that he's good at words. He's just good at them.
I love the palatability of your joy in that exclamation.
Still can't write sex scenes, though. Still can't. That has defeated him. There's one in this, and you're like, this one, you know, this one has sort of a promising love story behind it. This could be nice. Oh, no, it's horrible.
Ah, his Achilles heel. One day. Keep trying, Joe. We know you'll get there eventually.
What if we discovered that his other pen name is Jennifer L. Armentrout, and he actually writes really sexy sex scenes, but he can't mess up his brand with that? So,
maybe.
So,
we have this great scene. There's also another element here as we get to go, and I really want to talk about now just where our characters end.
Yeah, okay? we'll skip the Magnificent Seven bit.
All right.
No, we will.
Heroes ride back in to save the day. Yeah.
That's what we got to say. There's a great standoff. Lamb does an interesting thing where he's incapable of doing good, but he's capable of doing the right thing. The right thing is ultimately pointless, but this seems to matter to him and to the other characters that they stand, that they fight for something good or something right.
And following on from this, like I said, everyone gets their moments. Temple gets to make a stand. Lamb gets to make his sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people die. There's a thrilling chase scene down a mountainside.
Yes.
Amazing.
It's really good. You get people fighting on top of a carriage. What could be more Western than that? There is a bit, though, where he refers to the wheels as tires, and I'm like, what the fuck? What? No, don't. They're not tires.
Oh, you slipped up there, Joe.
Yeah, that's weird.
Hours are flying back and forth. This is a great scene. But it all comes back down to... I'm almost about to talk about another great scene. This is a great scene with an actor pretending to be an imperial ambassador. And politics and, God, people bluffing to the highest level to win the day.
It's such an amazing bit. And again, another amazing scene, and the ending is just packed with them, is Temple's confrontation with Koska at the end when he finally... properly says no to his face, and he challenges him down to his very soul, where he says, what do you want? Like, why do you think the gold would make you happy? And it's such a great moment, because this could be so cringy. It really could just be embarrassing Saturday morning cartoon stuff. But the characters are so complete, and they're so well set up to be diametrically opposed, and in the way they've turned down riches and instead going for what matters, that when Koska's met by this and is stumped, it feels beautiful. It feels complete.
I also really like in this sort of reveal at the end, where Koska actually talks about Temple, and people are like, why do you put up with this guy? Like, you've brought him back into the fold.
Mm-hmm.
And Koska goes, because I think he'll be my replacement.
And it's just so baffling, because in so many ways, Temple is his opposite. He's craven, and he's not very fun. He's really, the weird thing about it is that he's very competent at a lot of things, but not killing. It's the only thing he can't do. He's a really good lawyer, and priest, and carpenter, and a so-so medic. But you don't get the impression, why do you think he'd be good at running a mercenary gang? And basically, Koska's idea is that at some point, he will break him. He doesn't say this explicitly, but it's to be understood. He'll break him, and he'll warp him into a man as broken as Koska. And when he does that, yes, then he would actually be a suitable replacement, and the world would have another dog in it.
But thankfully, Temple resists, and let's go to the end. Let's go to the beautiful sunset scene.
Yeah.
We rescue the children. We travel back across the far country to the near country, and we end up back on the farmstead. And Temple and Shy, they've come together. Temple's practicing, you know, the good, wholesome life. Shy's still kicking him up the arse now and again. And we get Lamb, who we've established, the most lovable, terrible person I've ever read about. Because he is... I do love this character. And we finally get the end of another character's arc. Cole Shivers rocks up.
Yes. And he has been in the story. He shows up twice in the whole story. He rocks up in the midst of Koska's band saying, "I'm looking for a man. I took a little break to become a kingmaker in the north. I had a little holiday from my quest for revenge, but I'm back." There's a scene where he runs to Temple and he continues to establish himself as a mean motherfucker. And then he vanishes. He's mentioned every now and then, but the point is you're kind of supposed to... I'm not sure. Either I think you're supposed to forget he was even in the book, or he's just supposed to be this thing you're always thinking about. And I certainly was at the end of his story. I constantly was thinking, it's not over yet. It's not over yet. The past won't stay dead.
So, the day comes and the last standoff happens. Cole Shivers tracks down the man who murdered his brother. He tried to walk away, but that went very badly for him in Best Served Cold. Go and read that to find out how that went down. And now he has his opportunity. Oh, Geordie, this scene. I loved it.
Yeah.
Because there's so many ways I thought this could go. For a character like Lamb and the Bloody Nine, I thought this could be the way a man of violence always has to meet violence in the end. And Cole, I thought, was the man who wouldn't be scared of him. Unlike Golden Glamour, like Shivers has seen enough and he will be rock solid. And this could be
his end. He's just as crazy. That's the thing, is that he revels in violence and he's as addicted to it as the Bloody Nine. He has become him in some ways. They see that in each other, so it makes sense. This guy, yeah, he might just be crazy and violent and dangerous enough to do it.
So they look at each other, and in a very similar way to Gorsk's interaction with Cole at the end of The Heroes, Cole just asked Lamb, "Are you the Bloody Nine?" And Lamb goes, "Nope." And Cole goes, "Okay then."
He says, "Yeah, Bloody Nine's dead." Like, and it's amazing. It's just the last thing I ever would have expected. Not a lot of books really genuinely surprise me. Nothing else in this book actually surprised me except this. It's Cole Shivers who says, "Yeah, that's enough." It's Cole Shivers. Shivers! Who says, "There's not going to be any killing today." He found the man who he said all this time he's going to get revenge on. And he puts away his sword and he walks away and he says, "It just feels good to let go of something."
So satisfying. It really speaks to the fact that Cole wasn't seeking the Bloody Nine to like kill him. What Cole was always seeking was closure.
It's the last thing I expected. Cole Shivers made an emotionally healthy choice.
And then what we get is our very traditional heartfelt ending. It's not quite ride off into the sunset for more adventures. I don't think that's quite the tone.
It's kinda, but it's a dark twist on it.
Yeah, Lamb goes back to his sort of maid family of Shy, Temple and the kids. And he kind of says, "Listen, I'm a bad man. And if anything, if this story has taught me one thing, it's revealed to me that that is true. I thought it wasn't." It's that brilliant inverse. It's not, "I'm a bad man, but you show me the warmth in my heart." It's, "You've really shown me that I was always fooling myself." And I think this is this moment, correct me if I'm wrong, where it might be a little bit early. It might be just before we fight the dragon people, where Lamb reveals that when he saw the farm burning at the beginning of our story, It wasn't, you know, it wasn't fear for their well-being. It wasn't rage at the injustice or what he had to do to get to save the kids or get revenge. It was the fact that what Lam felt looking at that burnt farmstead was relief, because he no longer had to pretend he was a good person anymore.
It was joy.
Joy. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Even better. Thank you.
Yeah.
Joy. That. Do you know what? No, that is perfect. That is actually incredibly important detail. And that reveals so much. Yeah. He's like, oh, I'm so happy. Yeah. I am not happy unless I get this opportunity.
So he steps away. He says, I'm so messed up that I can never be with you. I can never be with you made safe. And the one thing I never regret in my life was choosing to be your father. And it's bittersweet because you want him to be able to settle down and be at peace at last. The last thing he had to deal with. You know, the reason why it's so effective that Cole vanishes from the story is he is this shadow which are waiting to catch up. The thing which could shatter their peace and their happiness. And he goes, but it doesn't solve their problem. Just in the same way that if he had killed Cole, he wouldn't have put his demons to rest. Even when the fight doesn't happen, he's done too much. He has too many enemies. He has too much darkness in himself for them to ever be safe around him. So he has to leave. And he does ride off into the sunset. And I don't know, Duncan, but I have to assume that that's the end of the Blighted Nine. I don't think there could be any more stories about him. Again, I don't have as much familiarity with him as you do, but I really feel like that has to be the last story. What else is there to say?
I can pull back the curtain on that slightly. So although there is another trilogy set after this book in this world, the Bloody Nine does not feature. There are some very vague allusions to the character, but this is the end. This is the end of his story. And good. I love the fact that it's left to you, the reader, to kind of decide what happens. You know he can't settle. So the idea is eventually he's just going to have to, he's going to go down in a fight one day. And it probably won't be glorious on that day. Probably won't be for a good cause.
No, surely not.
That's the end. Well, wow. That is not just the end of Red Country, not just the end of the Bloody Nine and characters like Cole Shearers and Nico Costa. This is the end of Joe Abercrombie's second standalone trilogy of standalones.
It really needs a name.
It does.
Does it have one?
I don't think so.
Dang.
If you're looking to get into the First Law series, you know, there are three effective trilogies. Geordie, I started you off on the second trilogy. One, because I heard it was written to be standalone. I wanted to test that theory. And two, because I thought Best Served Cold would be a much stronger opening than The Blade itself.
Until this point, I would confidently have said yes. That confidence has been shaken somewhat because I do wish I knew more about The Bloody Nine. But I can't say it meant I had a bad experience. I've enjoyed this immensely. And it's actually quite hard for me to compare these books and to like rank them in my head, because I think there are more tedious parts to this story. But I think on the whole, it's probably better written and better told. And I think now, even if only by recency bias, I think this is the best one yet.
I really enjoyed Red Country. I think the only thing that maybe would detract from someone is if you just weren't vibing with the Western theme.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Like, if you find that jarring or it throws you off, because I'm not going to lie, if you're reading this and constantly being reminded of other stories, you know, The Searchers, Deadwood, and all of that, if you're the type of person where that pulls you out, then I can potentially see that being a problem. Like, and also obviously the issues around the representation of the ghosts and how that's handled. Sure. I also see that as a problem. But in terms of watching Joe Abercrombie improve his craft as a writer, I think we've seen him do that consistently across these three books. And for someone who read the original First Law trilogy, I would say that he shows that he consistently improves book to book to book. I've not yet read a new Joe Abercrombie book that I didn't think was better written than the last.
I'm really worried about going back to these first books now. I think they are going to be a bit of a letdown.
I just want to say, I love the First Lord trilogy, and it is great. The only weakness is the fact that I do think that the very first book, The Blade Itself, does take a lot of time to get going. And because it's the original trilogy was plotted as such, you don't necessarily get much of a complete narrative in The Blade Itself. It's completely part one. It's the setup. It's the setup for the next two books. And that's why I feel like it, particularly in our format, Geordie, where, you know, if we don't like a book, we might not cover the next one on the podcast. I felt like let's go for something a bit stronger that we got with Best Surf Cold. But again, Blade Itself, it's not a bad book. So if you do read The Blade Itself and you enjoy it, know that it only gets better.
And speaking of not continuing books, I think, Dunk, we should probably take a break from Joe Abercrombie.
I regretfully most certainly agree. If we you
get
want
24 books a year at most, and two of them this year were part of the same series, and we did a bunch of Star Wars books as well, and frankly, a lot of this year was spent on sequels.
It has been indeed. We finished off sort of three trilogies over the course of this year. It's been quite the adventure. If you, however, are listening and you do want to continue in the world of First Law, I would definitely say a great book to read is there's actually a collection of short stories set in the universe, which sort of covers events before, during the First Law trilogy and during this sort of trilogy. So there are extra tales of these characters before you start the final trilogy, which I'm yet to read, but from what I've heard, it just keeps getting better and better.
Well, one day I will read that. Maybe it'll be in a podcast. Maybe it won't. But Duncan, there is a book that we said would be on the podcast, and as God is my witness, it shall be.
Alas, the time has come. We will be covering Priory of the Orange Tree.
We never, ever go back on a promise. That's my ninja way.
I am not going to say looking forward to it, but I'm looking forward to it being over.
How far through are you?
If I said a third, I might be over-egging myself slightly.
Duncan, that's what you said a month ago.
I was definitely over-egging myself then.
Okay, well,
2 weeks ago,
I have finished a book, so I will give my complete thoughts, and Duncan, we will be doing the Scholomance trilogy pretty soon, I guess.
If you've been listening and have read Red Country or any of the other works by Joe Abercrombie or any other book that we have covered or yet to cover on this podcast, let us know what you think. The best places, as always, are Instagram, It's Just Fantasy Podcasts. Give us a follow there. You get updates of when the podcast comes out, as well as additional reviews and material relating to the podcast. Also, please take the time and just drop us a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform of choice.
Yes, please.
The one you're currently listening to on. Although if you want to like go between different platforms and just reviewing again, that's amazing. Not only does it make our day, but it helps the podcast reach a wider audience. It's a way of sharing, and sharing is caring.
That's true.
Obviously, there's always our Gmail. If you have a very long, complex question that you want to put across, write to us at itsjustfantasypodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. We take inspiration. As you found out earlier this year, we sometimes inspire entire episodes. Our Conan the Barbarian inspired a fanfic writing empire all came from a single comment. So please send them in. It makes our day. It's fantastic to hear from you.
Well, Duncan, I'm looking forward to talking about Priory, if nothing else, and I will see you then.
Till that time,
goodbye.
Bye.